myself. I'm Martin Williams, the president of the Conservation Society. And I'm just going to open these seminars by just saying a little bit about what the society is, what it does, and the purpose of the meetings. Well, the society was formed apparently in 1967 initially, and as the title suggests, it's to represent Yukoners' interests in conservation, in conservation issues, and to try and have some input into conservation issues. And then one very big conservation issue, and one very big issue which will decide very much the future of the Yukon is hydroelectric power and its use in the Yukon. And the Sigma report, which NCPC commissioned to study hydroelectric potential and ways of utilizing hydroelectric potential in the Yukon, is obviously a very important report, and that's how we got involved. Rob McCandless decided that this series of study sessions or seminars would be a very useful way of getting information on the report to the public and also getting feedback from the public on how they felt in it. And so what comes from these seminars, we don't really know. It's up to you, the people at the seminars, to ask questions and to find out things, and hopefully you'll go away more informed, and the society might have some direction also in which to take after these seminars. So, a very brief introduction. I'd like to hand it over to Rob McCandless, who's the chairman and who also did all the organizing for this.
Well, I don't have too much to say except to introduce Hector McKenzie, who would give a brief explanation of what this thing is. This is the Sigma Report. This is volume one. There's three others, two of which we haven't found yet. But,
I've had quite a busy weekend with volume one. I'm quite glad volumes two and three haven't turned up yet. However, I wish to provide a synopsis for those people who haven't had a chance to look at a copy and give you some information from it. It's full of facts and graphs and maps. And I'm only going to attempt a sketch of the report, because there will be eight specialists speaking in depth about the various aspects covered. Sigma Resource Consultants were commissioned by the NCPC to write a report, and the title of this one is The Development of Power in the Yukon. It's quite interesting to bear that in mind, and it's not only for this immediate project, but of course it's going to try and plan the future as far as 1990 and perhaps beyond that. There's a description of the existing sources and the present supply is between 40 and 45 megawatts, and they've planned a couple of projections of population and the electrical load to give indications of supplies up to 75 megawatts or 100 megawatts. This is divided into two categories. Case one category includes a certain amount of population growth and industrial growth. And case two provides power for introduction of a lead-zinc smelter. Now this lead zinc smelter is referred frequently to the report, and it's used as a kind of lever frequently throughout it as being a tremendous requirement of power. And I noticed at one particular section in the report that it was referred to as a major uncertainty, and the planning will of course be very dependent on whether this lead zinc smelter is going to be developed in Yukon. Other possible large uses of electricity may be the electrification of the Bright Pass railway line, and possibility of a pulp mill in the Watson Lake area, and that would use approximately 20 megawatts. Some interesting facts about domestic use, which has almost doubled in the period of 1967 to 1972. The electric space heating in houses has become very popular. Something like 5% of the houses in 1967 had electric space heating. In 1974, 50% had them. And the figures are going up and up all the time. This appears to be because of the uncertainties of oil prices and the uncertainty of oil supply.
You're talking about new starts rather than old housing?
Yes. Yes, I am. There was a chapter describing the present sources of electrical supply in the Yukon, and these are exclusively hydro and diesel. Alternatives were investigated, and this is quite a short chapter, but other alternatives were solar energy, thermonuclear, which was described as being quite uneconomical for the kind of loads that are being talked about in the Yukon. Magnetohydrodynamics, which would utilize coal or natural gas. Dr. Craig will be talking about that later. Electro-gas dynamics, tidal power, and geothermal. But there's very little information given about the studies done in these other sources. Hydro was given tremendous emphasis as being an available source and a proven source, and being comparatively cheap. It's been studied in great detail for approximately 15 years, and this report is composed of information from many other reports submitted over these last 15 years. And a brief description or a reference to 100 sites being investigated in the Yukon, and that's on almost every river I can think of in the Yukon. And this is broken down into the most promising sites and the least promising sites. There are several categories in between. It's described as level one, selected primary sites. If you're interested, I could give you a quick list of them. One, the sites on the Liard River, the Liard Canyon, Francis River, the Upper Canyon, False Canyon, Lower Canyon, and the Teslin River, the Swift River, and the Upper Yukon, the Utalapa, Big Salmon, Five Fingers, on the Pelly River, Braden's Canyon, Granite Canyon, Detour Canyon, Ross Canyon, Bull Canyon, and the Stewart River, Fraser Falls, Hess, 2 Mile Canyon, and Independence. Category involved there. The Tatsunshinyi River, the Border Canyon, Bates River, Bates Lake, Primrose River, the Rose Lake, Lower Yukon River, Wolverine, Britannia, Ruby, Upper Dawson, Boundary. And it then goes on to the other information, the other lists of available sites. At the end of this chapter, there's a cost comparison on hydropower and oil-fired thermal. And again, this provides a very strong case for hydropower, suggesting that the cost could be double oil-fired thermal, where you're bearing in mind that oil prices are very likely to increase considerably, especially if they increase to the level of the international prices. Having established a very strong case for hydropower, there's a description of the dams and the reservoirs, and the introductory chapter here makes a few interesting comments, saying that the evaluation of dams and reservoirs has become increasingly complex as social values have changed and public participation has grown. The Science Council of Canada seems to have taken up this issue here and is planning to meet the environmental assessment challenge with a four-step process. And this is going to involve the government considerably and the public considerably. And this step one, a preliminary assessment before any decision to proceed. Two, a second more detailed assessment, including the appraisal of alternatives, should potential problems be uncovered by the first phase, and again before any decision to proceed. And three, if the development is approved, continued study as design and construction progresses to minimize impact and maximize benefits. Four, an analysis after completion to check on the accuracy of predictions so that methods can be refined for future assessments.
What step is this segment? Is this?
I would presume that this is the preliminary assessment. I'm not really very sure what
It seems to me that it's the second phase. You might remember that last Christmas they had a junket up here and they held public hearings. And they handed this out. Come and participate, make your choice. It seemed to me that at that time they were introducing five sites. And the Sigma report follows as a result of the public hearings. So it is a second stage, I think.
The reservoir clearing costs appear to be a very significant part of the total cost of our hydro project development. And a figure of $600 an acre was arrived at. There was quite a detailed specification as to what was to be cleared and what was to be left here. There's another section here involving the Science Council of Canada, which I found particularly interesting. And it's with provision for including the public and encouraging public participation, and also the wish to provide complete information to anyone who wishes to be informed, and this is to be available. The incorporation of public views and information in the planning process, an assessment of whether or not the project is publicly supported, and this we hope to get more public input in these seminars so that the government and NCPC will be more aware of whether the projects are publicly supported. And lastly, in this section, the improvement of communication between the public and the government to demonstrate accountability of the political and administrative decision makers and to enhance public confidence in the decision-making process. Several chapters are fairly specialized, and I feel that the speakers will be covering them. They are briefly fish resource, wildlife resource, forest resource, mineral resource, recreational values and tourism, historic and scientific values, community. Yes, these five there, six. Will somebody speak there?
No.
After these chapters, there's a discussion of the communities and the population trends, and there were there are projections for the population and the kind of role requirements that the population will require. It was stressed here that the Northern Canada Power Commission is responsible for meeting power demands and not planning future economic growth or social structure. And having read that and having read the continual reference to a lead zinc smelter, I couldn't help feeling that the power demands and the economic growth and social structure are very closely allied. The environmental and social impact was dealt with, I felt, fairly briefly, and there was a reference to the possible inundation of Carmack's or of Mayo or of Pelly Crossing or of Stewart Crossing, and the possible loss of viability at Old Crow or at Fort McPherson. And this was, of course, not discussed in this report. It's referred to as being a socio-political issue outside the realm of hydro planning. There was then a detailed assessment of the effects of each of the 10 most promising sites, and that was the effects on the environment, on the, well, the entire environment. And the final chapter before that vast amount of charts and maps and diagrams and graphs was a preliminary selection of leading schemes and system planning. And again, there was some interesting information and suggestions of either several smaller hydro projects or one vast hydro project, and cost comparison was quite interesting here. For a small hydro project, of which could be assessed as being 30 to 50 megawatts, the cost per kilowatt would be $1,200. And for a large project of 300 to 350 megawatts, the cost could be as low as $800. And again, these were tied in with the caseload one without any vast industrial development, and caseload two with a large industrial requirement in the form of the lead zinc smelter, electrification of the railway lines, etc. And about half the report is concerned with the facts and figures in detailed form of this, and I'm not particularly good at looking at charts, so the first half covers it in writing, and the second half appeared to me to emphasize it in detail in comparison charts and graphs here. One of the things that did particularly interest me was the encouragement of the public to participate in the hearings, and I found it quite encouraging that there is a chance for the public to influence the eventual decision, and just hope that we can get this information across to as many people in the UK as possible who are concerned. Like to see a sensible answer to the problem, and it would appear to me that there's no doubt about it, a project is required, and it's a case of deciding the best possible place with the least amount of environmental impact.
For those of you who came late, Hector McKenzie has just been speaking generally about the Sigma report, what's in it and what it and its importance. Are there any questions on just the general report before we move on to the first seminar?
Yes.
I'm wondering the reference you made to the Canada Council there for stage program. Is this compulsory? Is it recommended? Or what status is this?
It appeared to have been recommended to the government, but there was no indication of whether they must carry that out. Again, there was no reference. I didn't get that impression from that at all.
So it's maybe a
period. Yes, I think so. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, that's the Science Council.
Yes. Supported and how that assessment was going to be made.
Do you think any project would be publicly supported?
That's a relative question.
I think you substitute politically palatable.
Yes.
that city in connection with any project. That presumably would be a third stage plan, and then do the geology of a proposed dam site.
You read out there a list of about 10 or 15 possible sites. Well, does it say in the study how NCPC had decided to broadcast before the signal report was produced information on only 5 sites? Does it say how and why they picked only these 5 sites for the hearings in January of the information sessions?
Set out an order of priority and the feasibility of these sites needs to be discussed the most likely.
Yes.
That's, you know, because you can just confuse you if you are looking at both of these sites.
Yes.
Or you give them some
basics of electricity. And Daryl is a professional electrical engineer, and he's been with Yukon Electric now since last year, and he's formerly with Calgary Power in Alberta.
The discussion about electric power.
I think you can try to speak up.
Can you
hear me?
In the discussion about electric power, there are many places one can start. I propose to start at the source, that is the prime mover, and follow the system through to the customer. There are 3 main prime movers in this state. Controlled created by controlled fission of nuclear fuel, such as uranium, and reactor. Water under pressure, heated from boiling, is circulated through the reactor, removing heat. Heated water leaves the reactor and passes in a steam chamber. Dirty water from the reactor gives up heat to a separate system of water not under as much pressure does boil. This produces steam. The pressure of the steam is then applied to the blades on the shaft of the turbine, forcing the shaft to turn. From this point on, the nuclear plant operates the same as conventional boiler plants. Nuclear fission accounts for less than a quarter of energy consumed today. It is expected to supply 43% to 50% of energy consumed by the end of the century. Generally speaking, for most systems today, hydro is used for peaking. Thermal and nuclear plants are used for base loads.
I think we should explain those two terms if we could.
Base loads refer to the plants which are run continuously at their rated capacity, while peaking refers to the plants which are operating only when a customer load demands exceed that of the requirements supplying the base load. This arrangement is necessary due to seasonal variations of load. Once the shaft of the turbine is moving, it's a simple procedure to convert the mechanical energy to electrical energy. The common unit for electrical energy is the kilowatt hour, which is equal to 1 kilowatt of power supplied to or taken from an electric service steadily for 1 hour. Power is the rate at which work is done as compared to the amount. Basic unit of power is the watt. A kilowatt is 1,000 watts. A megawatt is 1,000,000 watts. A gigawatt is 1,000,000 kilowatts. The average system today is in the order of megawatts. But today, these systems are generating in the order of gigawatts. A generator is defined as a machine transforms chemical energy into electrical energy. The essential features are a field or assembly of magnets arranged to produce a magnetic flux. Two, an armature or assembly of electric conductors arranged across the path of magnetic flux. Once motion is produced between the magnetic flux and the electric conductor, this motion induces the electromotive force in the conductors. Electromotive force can be thought of as electric pressure that forces electrons to flow when the switch is closed or a circuit is completed. The flow of electrons through a conductor has to be in the way for a state of time period that's commonly called the electric current. The ampere is the unit of measurement of electric current. Voltage or now input is the unit of electromotive force or electric pressure. It is the force which is steadily applied to a circuit which has resistance of 1 ohm that produces a current of 1 ohm. Thus, 1 ohm of current flowing under a pressure of 1 volt will represent the rate of energy transfer that is 1 watt, which is the basic unit of power. Once electrical energy is created, it must then be delivered to the customer. Since most plants are situated in areas remote from the urban centers, it is necessary to have a means of transmitting the energy for long distance. As one raises the level of voltage, the distance energy can be transmitted also increases. In most electrical plants today, the fine transformer, which is an electromagnetic device used to change the level of voltage. This transformer is area, step up transform. As it name, as its name implies, transforms the low voltage of the generator up to a high voltage as required for transmission. The transmission line consists of structures used to transfer large amounts of power to major load centers. These structures can vary in size according to the level of the voltage used. The size of the wire is determined so as to minimize losses. Line loss is the general term applied to energy losses in the form of heat given off in the resistance of the wire. Once the energy is at the load center, it has to be distributed to the customer. Since the transmission voltage is too high for the customer needs, it becomes necessary to step down the voltage. Thus, the transformer is again required. The general practice today is to place a substation near the load center and step down the transmission voltage to what is referred to as a primary distribution. It's to try to maintain a constant voltage level to the customer for a variation of 12 plus or minus 5% for any larger disturbance. Any larger disturbance cannot be compensated by regulators. Also, substations have equipment used for protection of the distribution system. When one line has a fault, it will not work. So that the protective equipment will isolate the fault and leave the rest of the system intact, thus increasing reliability of service. Putting the substation, the power is delivered to the customer by distribution lines. The voltage of this line is still not low enough for the customer's use, so another small transformer, usually mounted on a pole, is necessary. The low voltage side of this transformer is then fed to the individual customer at the usable voltage level. That seems to be the way the utility stops.
Could you describe something of the physical plant that uses electrics here in town, like the fish lake hydro or something that could probably be a problem for this? I don't think many people are aware that Yukon Landfill has a hydro plant on the...
Yes, we have a small hydro plant. It's about 1.5 megawatts. There's three generators, basically the type. We have an intertidal. Substation feed 34,000 volts to our system, to our substation, and we distribute it from there.
What are these
from the fishery?
Yes.
Yes.
There's some comments in the fishery.
I wouldn't be certain, but I would assume it would be the size below in the territory.
Yes,
as compared to like where nuclear power is in the very large load centers.
There's a juicing approximately 750 megawatts. Versus the 350 megawatts.
I could just interject a little here. Just received some information today, and in it is a statement here that the first nuclear power plant in Canada went into operation in the late 1950s. It's a today there are 7 nuclear electric power generators in operation in the country, 10 under construction and 9 in the planning stage. So in the whole of Canada there aren't many. I think nuclear power is still in the experimental or development stage, I should say.
Perhaps on that note, we'll lead right on to Mr. Wagner to talk something about how electricity is bought and sold.
Thank you for inviting us here tonight. I had sent out for some information so I could sound like I knew what I was talking about, and it didn't arrive, so we've all got a problem here. The portion that I was asked to talk on was concerning rates and their application and so on, and it's really not that simple. That is, there's a lot of study and planning goes into rates and their applications. So what I will do is try and explain what I know and how we apply rates. And I would welcome any questions from you. And if I can't answer them, I'll try and find out what the answers are. Just before this, I noticed also that little clipping here today on how we use our energy. And this was before 1973. The use of energy in Canada is electricity 27%, oil 44%, gas 21%, and coal 8%. Go on to say at present about 2/3 of Canada's primary energy demand is met by oil and gas, 1/4 by electricity, and 1/10 by coal, nuclear, and wood, at about 1% apiece. It says round out that picture, energy experts generally agree by the end of the century the oil and gas share will drop proportionately, and electricity, both hydro and nuclear, will rise to about 30% of the total. I think we've experienced that in Whitehorse in the past few years. I believe it was 3 years ago, 2% of the new homes were being heated electrically. A year ago, it was somewhere in the order of 20-some percent. And last year, I believe it was 50. Close to 50%. I have a critic here, so I have to be careful what I'm saying. The rise in people installing electric heat in their homes is probably due to, for one, the increase in the price of oil, and I'm not too sure this is a good choice because with the price of oil going up, where a great portion of the power is generated by diesel fuel, the power rates are going to go up also. However, the original installation cost is also less, so therefore a number of people have chosen electric heating for their homes. We're not sure where it's all going to end, and a lot of it will depend on the cost of developing power supplies for the Yukon, whether that be hydro or coal or steam or whatever. Electric rates are based on the need for electric utility, whether it be government owned or privately owned, to obtain revenue from the sale of their electricity to pay off the investment they have in their power plants, their lines, equipment, and interest on bonds or stocks, and pay for the oils, fuels, and maintenance, wages, and so on, of the equipment that is operating. rates are generally set up to cover the cost of the above service, and also they vary within their own structures depending on the utilization and the manner in which the power is used. So, now, most rates other than residential, I'm going to those later, are based on the demand, that is the kilowatt hours are charged for on a basis of the maximum number of kilowatt hours used at any one time. We have some sheets here that we have put some electrical utility terms on, and perhaps we can just check those.
These are definitions of terms used in marketing electric
wanting to obtain one and they're not enough, if you call into our office at your convenience, we will run off another copy. We didn't know how many would be there. In the sheet you have here, demand rates are described as any method of charge for electric service which is based upon or is a function of the rate of use or size of the customer's installation, or maximum demand expressed in kilowatts, kilovolt amperes, or horsepower during a given period of time. What it is really is the maximum amount of power used at any one time. If, for example, if the customer uses 24 kilowatts, 1 hour, continually for 1 hour, he will create a demand of 24 kilowatts. And if he uses no more during the remaining 23 hours of the day, he will be billed for 24 kilowatt demand, that is 24 kilowatt hours, on a demand of 24 kilowatt, which is a higher rate than if the customer uses 1 kilowatt hour per hour for 24 hours during the day. He will still be billed for 24 kilowatt hours, but only on a demand of 1 kilowatt in that sense. Now this can get a little hairy at times, and perhaps I'll just go on, and if anyone has any questions later, we'll try and
Did everyone get that? I think it's analogous to sort of like you buy a big car with a big motor. You're paying for the big motor, but you're not necessarily driving it. Whereas if you're driving it, you're paying for the gas it's using too, but there's an additional cost for the,
that's right,
the capacity.
Okay, well, we're going back a little further. For a customer to use 24 kilowatt at one time, 24 kilowatt hours, and have the demand of 24 kilowatt at one time, we require wire that will carry the 24 kilowatt, a transformer that will handle the 24 kilowatt, a transmission line, and right back to the generating station. Yes? No. No, it's your, well, in a sense, but it's your continuous use of power. It's less expensive to provide power steadily than it is just for a short time, a great amount, and then nothing. For example, if all the consumers use power between noon and 6 p.m. in Whitehorse. They could shut the dam down and everything else from 6 p.m. through the evening and around the noon the next day. Whereas if they use power continuously, it is producing power on a steady basis. No. This is a pretty far out example, but okay, going a little further, one man is an operator of the plant, does no more work than the turbines are putting out 25 megawatt, and he does kind of putting out 1 megawatt. You still have to pay his wages. If you could send them home, yeah, right. Well, yeah, it doesn't work quite that way. You can't send them home because, well, no, if people have streetlights, they want streetlights, they like their fridges on. And so on. This is a... This is right. This is what I was going to say. If you were using, getting back to the 24 kilowatt, if you use this, you must size everything to handle 24 kilowatt for only 1 hour. And so you're only going to sell 24 kilowatt, but you do it in 1 hour. But if you use 1 kilowatt per hour for 24 hours, you only have to size everything for 1 kilowatt, and you still sell the same number of kilowatts, so naturally your wire sizes are smaller, your transformers, your generators, and everything down the line. If everybody does this, then you have a beautiful situation where the load is constant. You don't run into this, but it's a dream of power. Yes? The cause of the peak demand? Well, peak demands are caused by, in a system generally, of, say we run into a peak at noon where the cooking load for the households and so on all come on, just generally 11:30 to 12, or at 12. Again, we run into another peak here in the wintertime, when household lights are on, and store lights are on, and, people start cooking, all between, say, 4 and 6:30, 7 p.m. It starts to drop off a certain amount after 6, and the stores close down, and people go home.
Any other questions?
Heat here stays up later in the evening than it does for the south. I'm not sure just what it is. No, it doesn't fit that. We give a preferential rate for consumers who use power off-peak who can control when they use power. For example, in most communities, water pumping is a controllable item. They generally have a water tower which they fill from a river or a lake or a reservoir or whatever. And they can pump into this water tower anytime, and then when they maintain a certain level, and this water is supplied to the community by gravity, as required. So, where they will install a time clock, so they do not pump during peak periods, give communities a special rate, is it does not affect the demand in the system. And this is a benefit to them and to us also.
Is that a book about the White House, City of White House?
Yes. Also, for example, in White Horse, if a business or an establishment installs air conditioning, air conditioning is operational during the summer or warm weather, and this is when we do not experience a heavy loading condition here. So therefore, and this is pretty well true in most of Canada, in some of the warmer places, it's not true. The summer load is greater than the winter load, but in most of Canada, the winter load is greater than the summer load. So air conditioning units are basically not included in the demand. That is, their kilowatt hour consumption is billed only. There's no charge to the customer for the additional demand. Residential rates have traditionally been lower than commercial rates. This is for a few reasons. One being that historically residential customers have used power over a longer period of the day. That is, their fridges and hot water heaters and so on run automatically and continually. And therefore, they can, they're using power over a longer period of the day. And as I said earlier, there's no demand placed on residential customers. That is, if they use a large amount of power at one time, they're not billed accordingly. There is, commercial and industrial. They're all on meter, but they're not residential customers, not on a demand meter. That's right. The residential rate in Whitehorse is just over based the first 40 kilowatt at 5 cents per kilowatt hour, the next 160 kilowatt hour at 3.5, the next 100 kilowatt hour at 2.5, and the next 1700 are at 1.4. Then at anything over 2,000 is at 1.6. Now there's a reason for this also. The amount of 2,000 kilowatt will cover any household in the area for normal usage of block heaters, hot water heating, cooking, washing, drying, and so on. And if they use over that, they usually have electric heat installed. And we have a 0.2 cents increase for the electric heat because of the, once again, the use during demand periods, winter periods, and it's not used to too great an extent during the summer. We have the larger wires, larger transformers, and everything sitting idle in the summer, which is, to us, the poorest time of year to have it sitting idle. And of course, the other thing is, residential customers pay for their electricity out of their net earnings. That is, people receive wages and they have income tax deducted at the source and so on. So when you pay for your electricity, you are paying for that out of your net income. Commercial establishments pay for their electricity out of their gross income. And it is an operating expense that is deducted from their income tax. This is another sort of reason. Then you go on a commercial rate. The other the other group of consumers, of course, the industrial ones, such as oil pipeline pumps, lumber mills, pulp mills, mines, smelters, and so on. And these are the people who use large blocks of power 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. They are very easy to serve. They build a line into them, a little substation. And they have their own maintenance people. They look after their own distribution. And really, all you are doing is handling the power from point A to B and stepping it down to usable voltage, and then they take it from there. So, as far as the power companies are concerned, they're quite easy to serve, and they're no different than, say, one residential customer. You process one bill for them, and so just in larger volumes. Yes, we asked all commercial users, especially say CN and so on, to keep their power factor within 85%. And if they go below that, we then charge them a penalty for it.
Yes, you have power factor meters.
We check their power factor. Well, fluorescent lights have a very poor power factor. Some types of motors, your ideal load is heating, that is, incandescent lamps are resistible. They are pretty well unit of power factor. Yes. Oh no. It's just that we want to sell power to anybody. I didn't mean to be smart or anything. It's the cost of service to serve the large consumer. For example, this is why our residential rates are set on the first 40 kilowatt is at 5 cents, and the next 160 at 3.5, so on, it drops down to 1.4. The cost of preparing the bill and reading the meter and so on costs the same regardless of how much power you use. And so it doesn't matter to us, except that you have to attempt to recover these costs in your bill. There's another advantage for all consumers that large industrial loads give a base load to a plant, which results in a larger base load in the plant. The base load is what the plant generally runs at, and the larger this is, the more reliable, as a rule, the source to the remainder of the all customers. Pardon? Yes, we have a meter here that reads in most of them. I would think 1,000, 2,000 kilowatt could operate on, we have industrial rates for that all set up. Actually, the larger ones are, follow the same pattern.
This is what I think, we have a contract, right? And we're filming for same direction contracts, or since you know that's a huge deal.
There's a formula that we work out what it costs us to serve the customer and what the maintenance will be on our line and substation equipment and so on, and the depreciation and so on, yes.
Well, I'm sure you can do that, but the rate of return you can get from a particular large industry, with that subject to the industry, rather than to invest to a venture operations, would you perhaps with one rate?
Not generally, no. Not in the same area, no. It's based on the cost of service. And if our price is too high, they will go to, you know, their own equipment or different type of fuel or energy. In the Yukon, it may be a little different. But in Alberta, where there's gas available, they quite often weigh gas against electric. Here, I suppose you weigh, well, for a mine, you would weigh diesel generation or diesel power against. If the mine was far enough removed that you required to build so many miles of line, they would weigh the cost of your charges against them setting up their own mine. It's there's different ways of providing service, and even though electricity is the same, is what they will get in the end, it may not necessarily be. System, they may set up their own system.